Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Attention all small biz owners. At the UPS store, you can count on us to handle your packages with care. With our certified packing experts, your packages are properly packed and protected. And with our pack and ship guarantee, when we pack it and ship it, we guarantee it. Because your items arrive safe or you'll be reimbursed. Visit the upsstore.com/guarantee for full details. Most locations are independently owned. Product services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details. The UPS store. Be unstoppable. Come into your local store today.
Everyone, thanks for tuning into Power Athlete Radio. Finding the balance between coach, mentor, and collaborator takes more than a master's degree and a few internships. It actually takes years of experience testing your role and your approach to strength and conditioning. But not everyone is as forthcoming as Nate Brookerson of NC State. He believes that the real detriment to our community is the illusion that each coach has it all figured out. Nate has taken on the challenge of speaking more openly about training that has worked and protocols that have not worked. As he explains, the testing is about the individual, their abilities, performance pitfalls, and history of injury. In a position where you're expected to be an advocate for the student athlete and a loyal team player with the staff, it's important to run towards the difficult conversations rather than away from him. Those are the wise words of Nate Brookerson. Here's episode 331.
Power Athlete Nation, welcome to another episode of the premier podcast in strength and conditioning. That's your McConaughey pause. Ladies and gentlemen, today is a very special episode. No, it's not Matthew McConaughey.
I thought it was Matthew McConaughey.
McConaughey. It's like the...
It's every day.
The SNL where they had... I still remember it. Joe Montana. And I legit thought it was Joe Montana. And then that was like the skit of his opening. It's like there's a dad and a son in Joe Montana jerseys. And they're like, who's Joe Montana? And I still don't know to this day.
No, I thought that was the Water Boy.
Yeah.
That's in the Water Boy, you remember?
That's in SNL skit.
Oh, is that what that's from?
Probably stole. Yeah,
it was, Adam Sandler years for sure.
Oh,
for
yeah.
Joe Montana was a quarterback. You asshole.
He's like, I said Joe Montana.
Well, what are we talking about? Oh, I know why it's special. Because, ladies and gentlemen, there are only a matter of weeks left to get your ticket to the premier experience in strength and conditioning in Austin, Texas.
In the world.
In the world.
Ever.
Ever. December 5th, 6th, and 7th. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm talking about the Power Athlete Symposium, the 2019 capstone event for this organization and our coaches network and our network of super sharp and smart and inspiring individuals that we want to put on display and present to our followers, those who are fortunate enough to show up, get their ticket, and party.
I think sometime or the last time something was this influential was a couple Greeks got together and decided to do some stuff a long time ago.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say when the meteor hit the earth and extincted the dinosaurs.
Do you know how fast the meteor was moving?
Impactful? Is
seven.
Is that like a punch?
No.
7 miles an hour.
They estimated the impact. It was a asteroid the size of Texas hit the earth and it was moving 15 miles a second.
15 miles a second? Holy fuck. Yeah. Just when that would even hit the atmosphere. Everything's fucked.
When I learned that and I was like, 15 miles a second? Jeez, I don't even know what the speed on that one is, but they said 15
Nobody
miles
does.
A second. I don't even know if anybody knows that.
Fuck, man. I was thinking about...
can you imagine the size of the slingshot that must have shot that thing? I just imagine there was enormous. Like a big giant with a big slingshot and
slingshot
just shot
around
that.
The moon.
A documentary.
What was... There was a...
What are you fact-checking me?
Oh, my goodness. You're way off. So, accordingly, this crater has a name. So that I can't even pronounce it. Chicxulub.
It's in Yucatan.
Mm-hmm. Well, go on.
right. Estimated diameter of 11 to 81 kilometers. That's either 7 or 50 miles, somewhere between that, and delivered an estimated energy of 21 to 921 billion Hiroshima A-bombs. That's the estimate.
I thought it was the size of Texas.
I'm fine with all the facts you've said. Nothing he has said has disproven anything you've said. So everybody's well, right.
But the story wins.
The safe is range, 11 to 81 kilometers. That's a big margin of error.
On what scale?
The NASA scale.
Exactly.
Now, what they did is they did projections. They have that deal where they're able to strip away, like they fly over, and I forget what the machine's called, but they're able to strip away all the jungle, and they were able to find the crater and based off of the impact of the crater.
So the crater itself is 180 kilometers. That's 110 miles for you Americans.
So let me go ahead and tell you what I was talking about. Has everyone seen Independence Day?
And this yeah, it was a documentary.
The documentary with
Will Smith.
Willie Smith. Great. Save the world.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's got Randy Quaid.
So here's the thing. Those spaceships that enter the atmosphere, right? Like, they're enormous. So when they come in to the atmosphere, don't they have to displace that air? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, like, think about pushing your fist into a balloon. The balloon deforms. So mm-hmm. that air...
Get into a crowded hot tub and the water overflows?
Well, I mean, assuming that there's no... Texas Flat Earth has the idea that there's this bubble over the top of our atmosphere.
It's a spinning disc. It's fortunate the asteroid caught it at the right moment, face up, to eliminate all those dinosaurs.
So if you have to displace that much air simultaneously with five enormous ships the size of Manhattan, doesn't that affect climate?
Yeah, I think what they said was that when the asteroid hit, it created a nuclear winter that lasted for like...
So you're still talking asteroids, you're talking flat Earth, I'm talking Independence Day. This show is doomed.
there's apparently another theory out called the multiple impact hypothesis.
Come on.
Yeah, give it to us.
To read it.
Holy shit. Is this a dramatic pause?
Yeah.
You can't read and talk at the same time? Obviously
do
not.
You want me to read it aloud?
Popcorn, yeah, popcorn rate.
I can't pronounce half these words.
The.
My. Our.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'll continue to talk about what I was talking about in the first place. The premier experience in strength and conditioning. That's right, people. We've ditched the clinic concept. It's no longer a conference. This isn't a seminar. This is an experience. You're going to show up to Austin, Texas, and we're going to immerse you in the Austin experience with a Power Athlete twist. We have a killer kickoff event featuring Wade's Army Silent Auction, benefiting Wade's Army. We have day two, a Power Athlete-led practical. The first 2 hours of your day are going to be led by Power Athlete John, myself, Tex, our coaches, and we're going to be torching you. We're going to be teaching you all sorts of new shit that you don't know about coaching and you don't know about training. That leads into some sort of group brunch type setup. And then we get right into speakers who are going to blow your mind. Here's what we're going to do day three. Rinse and repeat. But we're going to have some of the sharpest, most engaging coaches that we know lead their practical sessions so that you can walk away with something to apply, whether you're a coach, an athlete, or enthusiast, or a parent looking to set an example for their kids. Like, you're going to have tools in your toolbox, and your transformation is that weekend, baby. So if you are interested or you are snoozing, what are you even doing? Get to events.powerathletehq.com/symposium. Now, if you're wondering what the multiple impact hypothesis is, Tex has news for you.
Basically, 300,000 years apart. So they're saying, I don't know, it wasn't one big impact.
They struck in the same spot, 300,000 years away, apart from one another?
No, they're more than 4,500 kilometers apart. And one of them's in Jersey. That's all I could acquire in that 30-second promo that you went through.
300,000 years apart. How many generations is that?
Well, if you think about how long
dinosaur
the, well, think how about how long the nuclear winter lasted. So what did they say? There was something like the equivalent of like, what was it like? I forgot the number, but it was like the Hiroshima bombs. What did they say? Like a million? Wasn't like a million Hiroshima bombs going off at once?
It was 21 to 921 billion.
Okay.
Fuck.
So the nuclear winter associated with that probably blocked out the sun for a couple hundred thousand years and basically turned the world into this like fucking crazy ass ice age.
So,
and then the dissipation. I mean, just think about the dust that went up to create that nuclear winter is pretty amazing.
Yeah, and the crater is, what country is this?
It's in the Yucatan.
Central America.
Yeah, it's down in Mexico.
Mm-hmm. Is that Mexico, that tip?
Yeah, that's the Yucatan Peninsula.
Okay, Yucatan Peninsula. Yeah. I'm going to put that on my travel bucket list.
It's, we just went there to Tulum.
I read a lot of reviews because when we were in Belize, I thought about doing like a day trip out there. And the reviews all say, like, just looks, it's so fucking big. Like, when you're there, you can't even tell.
Yeah.
So you just got to feel like you're excited about being somewhere. And let this be a lesson for any future filmmakers out there. Should you have gigantic solids entering Earth's atmosphere, address the meteorological impact.
I was kind of thinking.
It's not the aliens that threw you off.
No.
It's the lack of displacement of
the Earth. It is. But Luke, that actually makes a really valid point. Like, you know, if you think about like the atmosphere and the way it sits in terms of like trapping oxygen in it, when you have that much air displacing, what happens? Does the Earth compress? Does it compress into the water? That's does it dissipate?
Saying. The Avengers are huge fucking, huge violation of.
Of physics?
Damn it. I forgot.
The space-time continuum?
God damn it. Space-time continuum for sure.
No, they figured that one out in Endgame.
Atmospheric. I'll think of some stupid term for next. That'll be next episode, people. Cliffhanger. Let's just talk about this episode. Right?
Well, let's go back to this Endgame thing. Right. This is okay. Something that I was...
Hang on, spoiler alert, people. If you haven't seen it...
I was watching it with the kids. We've been trying to work our way through Endgame. The question they hit me with, which I couldn't answer, was what mutant power or what superpower does Black Widow have? Isn't she just a spy? Because she was getting like her
and
beat
so when
up.
And so when we were talking about a celebrity on the Crew podcast, who to whoop ass with... In a street fight, remember that one? Mm-hmm. I was going to go Black Widow, but like I was worried that maybe she had superpowers, which would ultimately disqualify her.
But upon further investigation, she was like a Russian operative that was trained, but she doesn't actually have any superpowers.
Neither does Batman, the world's greatest detective.
Yeah, but Batman gets his ass kicked constantly, and he has a suit. Black Widow doesn't have a suit, and he's got a whole bunch of cars and crazy shit.
Black Widow dies.
Whoa. Can't we take
Batman never dies.
Like the silence?
I mean,
she sacrifices herself. You fucking asshole.
You saw that as a sacrifice? Arrow tried to sacrifice himself. What's his name?
Arrow.
Guy?
Arrow is a hero.
Hang on.
And that is a show that is completely going to be so far ahead of its time that we're not even going to know it's a classic until like 100 years
from now.
So
John would like to amend who he would like to get a street fight with, and it would be with Arrow.
Oh, I would fucking beat Arrow's ass. Every time I show...
Catch him first.
Dude, you know what?
Hawkeye, not Arrow.
Yeah, Arrow, it's so bad.
Who's Hawkeye?
Jeremy Renner.
Yeah, Jeremy Renner has his own social network.
The Arrow shows with like Flash, CW. Like the CW superhero shows, are like, they're like just really not good. But I like them, but they're great.
They're flashy enough to keep you entertained.
Yeah, no, I mean, the storylines keep building, like you're in season three, you got no idea what's going on.
But they eventually hit a point where they're like, well, I feel like they're like, the panel really responded well to this character. Let's make a huge storyline around them.
Dude, there was a weird one we watched recently that has this like giant shark. And so every time he comes on, I'm like,
Arrow the jumped, Megalodon.
Arrow jumped the shark?
Seriously jumped the shark. But I think the Arrow's going off air. They're done. Thank God.
Are you heartbroken?
Seven episodes.
Back to the Friends collection.
We're not into Arrow. We like Flash. So that's when we watch on Sundays. Sunday morning, I let the kids watch Flash.
Mm.
I kind of dig Flash. I got to think of any of the superpowers I've seen. Flash is by far my favorite. The dude like can move so fast. Like it's just crazy. Like bullets flying. He just kind of flicks them and they go away. I think it's cool.
Mm-hmm. Which we don't have to get into the physics of that, but I'm a little concerned by it.
Well, his ability to reverse the rotation of the disc.
I can't do it anymore.
He ran so fast, he was able to time travel.
Yeah, him and Superman. It went the opposite way of the Earth's rotation.
There's a lot of... I don't think that the people writing the show know much about physics or actually like what is possible. They're like, ah, they're watching a superhero show. We'll make this shit up.
It reminds me of when Tony Hawk, the original Tony Hawk game came out. It was like kind of revolutionary because it had realistic physics. And then you play it and you're like, what?
They're actually coming out with a documentary about the game and how it just revolutionized skateboarding and, and changed the culture.
And fucking music and video games. Yeah. It's a legit soundtrack. Anyways, enough about literally nothing. Except for,
So what you're saying is that we're the Seinfeld of podcasts?
I think
it's
so.
A story about nothing.
It could be.
Like, dude, that was my favorite.
Just less talented.
It's when they were pitching the show. It's a show about nothing.
Mm-hmm. Don't Google Superman, physics of Superman. Don't do it.
Who, me?
Yeah.
All right. I will. All right, people. Today, Nate Brookerson, who is director of strength and conditioning at NC State.
Ing. Olympics.
Ing.
Olympic strength and conditioning.
Ing.
Thank you. Thank you.
Ing. Ing.
I didn't get an ing out of that guy. And we chat about coaching and he's got a pretty well-traveled
and he's a,
past.
And he's a thoughtful dude. He's obviously like thought through some stuff and has an opinion. And
drives the wheels off of his cars.
Yeah, the Mazda M3.
Mazda 3.
3. I don't even know
still
what that
got
is.
It.
I don't even know what a 3 is.
It's the smallest Mazda that you'd see out there. It's not quite a Miata, but it's just as cool.
Oh.
I'd fucking take a Miata. You, power athlete, fleet of cars, John. You have to get on a Miata kick.
You don't remember the Monster Miata where they were putting fucking big blocks into Miatas?
I believe it. I mean,
they were awesome. The Monster Miata was a fucking deal. You can shoehorn anything into that.
I want to get like a electric motor Miata.
I think personally for you, an RX-7 with a rotary motor would be badass.
Mm, yes, that's a 10-second car.
So you got to remember that the rotary motor is per cubic inch of displacement is like a 1-to-1 cubic inch of displacement to horsepower. So it's by far it's like a
super.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, that's some astronomical deal. I love the engineering of rotary motors.
So I Googled Monster Miata, and this is probably the greatest website I've ever been to. Mad engineering where too much horsepower is not enough. Welcome to the world of V8 powered Miatas. Here at Monster Miata, we think on the extreme end of things. Brute torque is the name of the game here, but handling strength and reliability will not be compromised.
Wasn't brute torque your nickname in high school?
Sure.
I thought that's how they referred to him when he worked at Balance.
The goal of Monster Miata is to provide a fun yet civilized daily driving car that can outperform those cars on the track. We're proud to say that we achieved this.
What did they put in it? Is it a small block or is it a big block?
V8.
Yeah, like what kind of V8 though? Are we talking like a 454, 463? Are we talking about a 350 strokers? What are we talking about?
Well, Tex is looking at an animated GIF
that says V8.
Cylinder heads.
MonsterMiata.com.
What
this show brought to you by MonsterMiata.com.
Are they running them in
where
the
horse? Are they running them in just the
front?
Enough.
Are they running them in the front or the back? Are they going like rear engine? Are we going with the transaxle?
Tex doesn't know any of that, and he's trying to scroll, and the page isn't even moving.
Okay, what does that say? They put a 4302 in it.
A 4302 V8 Miata kit.
Ooh, it's how much?
It's a small motor.
We'll take two. Ladies and gentlemen.
No. What's that one? That says an LS?
Enough.
Jeez. Okay, GM, so we can
LS,
put an
V8
so
Miata.
We can put an LS in there? All right.
It is time to get to the rhythm of the rhyme of the podcast. Nate Brookerson. Tex, are you ready?
Listos.
John, are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Let's
set,
do it.
Go. Go. Nate, okay, man. How about this? Let's start off. Our listeners know us because they suffer through our spiels like the one that just happened every week for hours.
I think suffering is pretty severe.
Yeah, it must be.
And that's what they have to deal with. Yeah.
It is severe. And the listener's like, yeah, John, you have no idea. But Nate, why don't you give them a little intro, man? I mean, take as long as you want. We got 90 minutes, maybe 2 hours, maybe 6 hours. Who knows?
Yeah, I know that. You know, strength conditioning coaches are famous for once we actually do get a chance to talk about ourselves that we can't stop. So I'll try not to go too far off topic or meander too much. But Name is Nate Brookerson. Currently, I'm an assistant athletic director for strength and conditioning at North Carolina State University, going into year five. So I direct the department of 6 full-time strength coaches, 3 registered dietitians, and a partridge in a pear tree. But, you know, in my role specifically, it's that kind of supervisory mentorship, you know, making sure that everything's just running smoothly. And then I work specifically with 2 very similar sports. So swimming and diving and women's basketball. So, you know, the day-to-day is spending time with those teams, but at the same time, it's, you know, making sure again, everything's kind of running smoothly on the other 22 sports that we have here at North Carolina State University. Prior to that, I was at University of Memphis for 2 years in a similar capacity. And then before that, I was at Eastern Washington University. So, you know, when I talk about being in this industry and people complain to me about, you know, hey, I've had to move or I've had to do some other things that were kind of difficult. Well, my life was, I was born in Washington. I went to grad school at University of Georgia. So got in a car about a week after I was married in a Mazda 3 with everything that we owned and drove across the country to Athens, Georgia. Again, being from the Northwest, you know, very, very similar place to where we grew up. And then from University of Georgia, after a year, I went back to Eastern Washington, was able to get a job offer there. So again, packed our stuff back up in the car, drove all the way back across the country to Cheney, Washington, spent 5 years there, worked my way into a director position, and then just decided one day that, you know, I didn't want to do football anymore and I wanted to try to pivot and see what other opportunities were out there. So then, you know, decided to pick a nice close place to Cheney, Washington in Memphis, Tennessee. And then at this time I had one son. So, you know, we packed everything up and squished him in a car and moved the family across the country to Memphis, Tennessee.
Had my son. Yeah, I hope.
I mean, we still got it. I drove that thing to work today. 93 degrees and no air conditioning in it, but you know, it's all paid off, so we're good. Had my second son at University of Memphis. And then, you know, after 2 years was able to get this opportunity at North Carolina State. I was hired by a gentleman named Bob Alejo, who, if you're not familiar with him, he's kind of a godfather in this industry. He's, you know, 30 years plus, worked in Major League Baseball. He was there with the Athletics when, you know, they were in their Moneyball era. And, he has moved on to a high level AD role at Cal State Northridge. And I moved into kind of his old role, and that's where we're at. So, you know, Raleigh, North Carolina now is home. I got 2 young boys, Brock and Blaze, 7 and 4 years old. And then I've been married now for 12 years. And still trying to figure things out, still trying to grow and decide, you know, what I want to do for a living and who I want to be and all those things. So, yeah, that's how we got here.
That's a wild ride, dude.
Yeah.
Just dragging your family all over.
I mean,
God's green earth.
Yeah. Teaching people to lift barbells. I have a very, very loving wife, understanding wife, and I got kids that are just kind of like, yeah, we're moving again. All right, let's go. You know, nice, just open for adventure. So yeah, I'm hoping to stay here a while, but who knows? As long as they have me and as long as I'm doing a good job, hopefully I get to stay here for some time. But yeah, the track record has been, you know, I'll probably end up somewhere on the West Coast again and back to the East Coast and back to the West Coast. So just never preferred small moves, I guess.
So why throw in the towel on football? That seems to be like the apex of any aspiring collegiate strength coach is to run the football program.
Yeah, no what question. The whole thing with football was, you know, I played for a long time. So I started playing football when I was 12 years old. You know, never thought that was going to be the future. Played all the way through high school and really wanted to be a basketball player. And actually got recruited to play college football off of a basketball game. So a gentleman named Bo Baldwin, who is now the offensive coordinator at University of Cal, actually came to one of my basketball games and saw me there and said, okay, I think you're athletic enough to be a football player in the college level. So ended up deciding to go play college football. So did that for 5 years. When I got done with that, the first kind of the gig that I had was training collegiate athletes to go into, you know, NFL or Canadian opportunities. And so, yeah, I thought that's what I was going to do. I thought football was the route. I kept trying to play football as well. I played arena football for another year of my life. Actually, strangely enough, made the team that I went to based on one of the athletes I was training saying, hey, I want you to come to the tryout and I want you to go through it with me. So showed up to the tryout, a gentleman named Jay White. He was from University of Nebraska. He went there as a safety. We went to the Everett Hawks, which was an Arena 2 football team in Washington. Went to the tryout. Jay didn't make it, and I made it. So stuck with football a little bit longer. And then when I first got away from it, when I saw maybe what the other side could be, I went to the University of Georgia for grad school. So after arena football was done, you know, I'm kind of searching for what I want to do. And my mentor at the time, I was working at a place called Velocity, which, you know, people that listen to the station might know Velocity is. It got big in the mid-2000s as a franchise. You know, it was training 8 to 18-year-olds kind of deal. But my boss was a gentleman named Rick Hughley. So Rick was the head strength coach at University of Washington for about 18 years. He was there with Don James during that Rose Bowl, you know, the 92 national championship. And Rick had the soft spot for collegiate athletics. And he's like, I think you would be a good college strength coach. And so his only advice was go to grad school, go do it for free, you know, find a good school and just go volunteer and do that. So I showed up at University of Georgia thinking I was just going to walk in the weight room and they were going to say, yeah, you played college football, you know, you got this background. Sure. You know, you can come in and volunteer. Didn't even send an email. I was that confident. Right. So I show up. And the gentleman who's there is a guy named Dave Van Hallinger. So Dave Van Hallinger was Bobby Bowden's strength coach at West Virginia back in like the late 70s. So he had gone with Mark Richt from Florida State to University of Georgia. So a guy that's been in it for many, many years, right? And here's me walking in. I'm 24. I'm saying, you know, hey, I want to be a football strength coach. I'd like to volunteer with you. You know, when do I start kind of deal? And I remember at the time, this is prior to, you know, now they have a rule of five. You can only have five strength coaches with football. We're looking around the room and he's like, everybody that has this red University of Georgia t-shirt is one of our volunteers. And there was more of those guys than there were athletes in the room. So basically he was saying like, I don't even have any space. Like I can't fit you in here. So there's no opportunities here. And so I remember thinking like, okay, well, crap, you know, what the heck am I going to do now? And at that time he just told me, he's like, we have an Olympic sports department. It's right across the street. There's some great coaches over there. You should go over there and see if they have some space for you. And I remember going over there and they had like no volunteers. You know, all these great athletes at the time, this is 2008 at University of Georgia. So you had a baseball team that was runner up national champions. They had Gordon Beckham, who's been the Major League Baseball forever. Josh Fields, who's still pitching the major league level. They had a national champion men's tennis team. It was their seventh year in a row winning a national championship in gymnastics. So all these unbelievable athletes. Maria Taylor for ESPN was there as a volleyball athlete. So this was like, you just walk into the door, you see world-class athletes everywhere. And I'm kind of like, I had no idea that this was even a thing. And they welcomed me with open arms. And that was where I felt like I got that taste of, wow, this is a really good opportunity. If I ever have this again at a high enough level, I think I would like to do this, you know, not saying I didn't like football at the time. But I thought it would be a good opportunity. So then I go, you know, back to Eastern. I'm with everything but football to start. And then when I moved into the director position, I was football pretty much only. Did that for 5 years. And, you know, at the time it was just, I was thinking about family. I was thinking about what the future looked like. And I just saw a lot of my colleagues and friends and everybody that had been doing it just kind of starting to burn out. Everybody thought they were going to go make, you know, Chris Doyle money or, Scott Cochran money. And it's just, there's a handful of those jobs. Right. And it just at the time didn't appeal to me as this is what I want to do long-term. You know, my goal was never to work with football. That's not what I got into it to do. It was to work with high level athletes that were motivated, in an environment that I wanted to be in a place I wanted to live and still have time, to spend with my family, to be able to go, you know, go to practices, spend time on the weekend and not just have to have that constant pit in your stomach of like, hey, we don't win, you know, 8 games and go to a bowl this year. We're out. And, you know, so getting out of it it was tough. I left in Eastern Washington, as an FCS program, but we had won a national championship in 2010. A lot of kids are still playing the NFL, Canadian football, a lot of good success there. But it felt like when this opportunity came up in Memphis, I got a call from a gentleman named Rourke Cutchlow, who's now at University of Missouri. And he knew, based on interactions with other people in the field, that I had the potential to make a shift. And he made the offer, and it was just right time. And it's like, yeah, I want another challenge. And, Memphis was a challenge. It was a little bit of a culture shock for the family, but it was the best decision I made up to this point in my career, because I was vulnerable, took a chance, and, it led me here. And, Raleigh is an unbelievable place, and this job's incredible. I love the athletes that I work with and the staff that we have. And again, I'm really blessed to be where I am, and not at all worried about whether it's with football or not.
This is great. So the connection that we made was at Jay DeMeo's The Seminar. So shout out to him, Richmond University. And you spoke on an interesting topic, and you said it earlier, vulnerability. And you spoke about kind of taking the ego out of the equation when one of your athletes faced an injury.
Echo.
So I want to talk about this. I want to talk about that perspective. So I'm sure you dealt with athletes' injuries, athletic trainers, physical therapists, surgeries, and all these previously. So was this a new position that you took when you had this athlete face this injury?
No, I mean, I really just spoke about that being kind of the position that we're all in. We're all, wherever you're at the collegiate level, you're going to be in a situation where you're not the be-all, end-all. You're not controlling everything about a rehab process. You're not the judge, jury on every decision. Ultimately, you have to work in a collaborative environment, and there's going to be times where you have opinions and you want to challenge somebody else's way of thinking or their perspective. And there is a challenge when you have so many people, so many cooks in the kitchen, when you're all working towards one common goal, but you maybe have different opinions of how to get there. So that's where I would say it's kind of started at Memphis, where it was more so about, once an athlete got an injury, we started having more of these conversations be less about like what I did or what the trainer was going to do or what sports medicine or physical therapist was going to do. More so, it was like, what are our checks and balances, or what are our audits along the way to be able to hold us accountable to something that we can all see and that we can all agree on is getting them closer to being able to get back to return to their sport. So really that's what that conversation was, the impetus of that speech was about. But that being said, you have your criteria based approach and all these things that you're trying to accomplish, but it doesn't always mean that it's this linear, everything was great and we did exactly what we expected. There was no setbacks. It was right on the same timeline that we all thought it was going to happen. That's just not the reality. But, in collegiate and professional athletics, people never really talk about their failures. It's funny to me. And you hear this more and more, where it's like this omnipotence of a lot of professionals, and, strength and conditioning is definitely up there in this type of thought process. Basically, like, every decision that you make is the right one. Like, I decided this was what we were going to do, and it was successful. Like, we know that's not true. Like, that you test, sometimes you have what you consider responders and non-responders. Like, we did something, these kids got better. We did something, these kids didn't get better. Like, but we tend to kind of push that narrative out to the side and just be like, no. Like, we did it. We decided to do it, and the kids all got better for it. I thought about, when I go to these conferences, how nobody, again, wants to reveal, hey, this didn't go exactly how we expected it to. This is what we assumed. This is what we were looking at, but the outcomes weren't quite there. And so I was just tired of waiting for somebody else to do that talk. So I said, I guess I need to be the one to start to do something like this. So, that talk at Central Virginia, I thought, for the most part, went pretty well. I know it's kind of like doom and gloom sometimes when you're talking about, like, yeah, the outcomes weren't the greatest, and like, well, what now? Like, everything's fine, right? Like, everybody wants this clean narrative at the end. Like, everything worked out and kumbaya, and, but, like, again, that's not real life. But hopefully that just gave some people in the crowd, maybe some younger professionals that don't have this, again, this omnipotent type of perspective where they think everything's right. At least maybe it gave them some courage to go back and say, okay, I've had these type of situations. Like, how can I deal with them more effectively? How can I learn from them? How can I, you know, again, challenge my own perspective on things and help them grow as professionals? So if that's all it accomplished, then, you know, nobody learned anything. Great. But that was, again, kind of what that talk was born out of.
Do you think the biggest issue you see is that it's more copycats, where everybody just wants to kind of carbon everybody else's program because they know they've had success? And if you start going out there and maybe have some original ideas and you put them into practice, and I mean, we've done this over the years where the ideas I've had didn't pan out the way that I thought they would, and they pivoted us in different directions. And
I think it's,
my experience is just people love to just carbon copy, you know, programs or, you know, philosophies, because they know in the past this was successful and this is a safe way of doing it.
Yeah, no question. That's the perfect word, right? It's safe because you can go back and be like, okay, this is the genesis of this thought process. This coach did this, or this university was doing this. And it's very safe. I mean, it's the same way that people refer back to literature, right? Like, I think that's a start. You have to find things that have been done before, and somebody actually has some, you know, objective quality around it. Like, it's been measured, it's been implemented. And then we have to have that same level of what we're doing. Like, we're actually tracking it, monitoring it. I lost you for a second. But the idea still is every athlete is an N of one, right? So you're taking, you know, you have this methodological thought process, this big picture of like what you want to do. But there's going to be things that maybe you need to tweak and change for this particular instance, right? Where it's like, okay, I'm looking at bringing somebody back from an ACL, and maybe I think the gold standard is, you know, patella graft, but this person had a hamstring graft. Well, what does that change in terms of what the rehab is? If I'm only referring to somebody that did an ACL return to play with somebody that had a patella graft versus hamstring, like, and I just copy that, I might miss a lot of things if I'm not measuring anything, if I'm not looking at what I think is important for that athlete. But again, that takes that N of one approach. And that's hard, right? Because training healthy athletes, a lot of times, this is where when people talk about things being simple, I think that's where it's fairly simple. Like, do a general assessment, understand what their limitations are, address those things, and move forward with a program that has logic to it. There's progression. Like, there's simple theories that are out there that you can find, you know, in theory of progression and overload and all these things. But when you have an athlete that has an injury, that changes a lot of things, not only physically, but psychologically, right? Maybe this person had this is the first major injury that they've ever had. And they're coming back and trying to deal with this, and, you know, high expectations, pressure, whatever that is, timelines that they kind of make up in their own heads. So that's where the challenges come in. So, you know, in order to carbon copy something like that, you're not copying this to an athlete that has maybe the same experience or surgical intervention or whatever as one that you're trying to emulate. So I think injuries always have to have the N of one mentality. Yes, you want to talk about when success is had and what you looked at, and maybe develop like a tighter window of like, these are the metrics that we think are important. This is what we're going to measure. And so, you know, we're not going to look at everything. These are the things that made sense to us in the process. But again, there's just uniqueness in each athlete through that return to play process that you have to acknowledge.
And just some notes from your talk, some of the tests that you did put into place simply as presented: pain, output, readiness, and sensory systems. I don't know if a lot of coaches have that into play, or they just have the old school like atrophy scale, or just get back to the strength or power that you had represented before. But it was cool to introduce just these different things that you and your team were checking out.
Yeah. I mean, like you said, it's, what does sport represent? Like, it, you can create like, okay, they are stronger, more powerful, or at what they used to be from a baseline perspective, but maybe, you know, movement quality is still a limiting factor. Maybe, you know, qualitatively how they're getting into positions. Like, for example, we have a girl that's coming back from an injury in women's basketball, and I'm looking at, you know, a change of direction test, where not only did I look at what the output was, but I took a video of it, and then I did still shots of what each cut looked like. So as she's loading in the affected and unaffected legs, like, how similar do those things look? Does she just load into the unaffected leg each time, regardless of where she's making a cut? Like, are these things in line with what we think her position, the posture should be like? So, yeah, I mean, it's, there's so many layers that you can look at. The qualitative piece, I think, is very important to sit down and look at that with coaches to get them to understand, like, okay, as this person's coming, you know, out of this cut into this jump shot, we have video of what they look like before because we have game video or practice video. Let's look at what they look like right now. Like, and then we can go back at the physical data that we have and say, okay, maybe the limiting factor is, you know, this concentric strength piece or rate of force development or whatever it is. And we can train those things. And again, that's your experimental approach to the problem. Like, do those things? Did we make the change that we expected? And sometimes it's going to be exposure to specific motor patterns and skills too. Like, those things are important. Like, if, especially if you're coming back from an injury, it's almost like you're kind of refiguring out how to do things that before you didn't have to think about. Now you have almost this idea of like, where do these skills start? Like, you have to think about them more, you know, in kind of the front of the brain before they're pushed in that posterior part of the brain where it becomes more just, you know, autopilot. And it's coming back to like front brain skills. Like, I got to think about how to cut. I got to think about how I need a load in this jump shot. I need to think about how I'm going to move defensively. Like, a lot of these kids don't, they haven't had to think about those things for years. So, you know, making sure that they become more fluid and less robotic and like programmed with movement quality as well. Like, you have to find where they can be successful, find that edge and kind of push them over the edge every once in a while. Like, the goal is not to, you know, make them fail every single day and just be like, you suck, you're not getting any better at this. But it's like, if you just keep doing like, okay, now you touch this cone and you're shuffling here and you shuffle there, like, you're not presenting any sort of, like you said, sensory element to it or more game-like type of environments. Like, that's not going to be what they're exposed to. Once the game starts, they're going to move how they're going to move. And if that's robotic, like, it's probably not going to be efficient enough to actually stay up with the competition, or it's, you know, it's going to open them up at risk for injury when they start getting fatigued and break down and go back to what they would do otherwise.
And I'm sure now with the most recent, like, Golden State Warriors in the playoffs and the injuries that they faced, the coming back too early, we have this representation to tell a tale of waiting. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think patience within an injury is really hard for a lot of, you know, kind of the constituents involved, right? When you have support staff, you have coaching staff, you have the athletes, you know, there always is going to be that pressure that, you know, and you've heard this said before, but like, this athlete at 80% is better than this athlete at 100%. Well, maybe so, but like, that athlete at 80% is not as good as that athlete at 100%. And, you know, I've heard things, people say like, well, if this athlete's hurt, like, they can still perform if it's this type of injury. Or, you know, it's almost like that subjective, like, well, when we feel like they're ready, you know, then we'll, you know, release them to competition. Like, I don't like to do those type of things based on feel. I think that's your secondary layer, right? And there's psychological questionnaires even and things like that you can give to athletes coming back from injury. But like, the first layer is the objective piece, you know, comparing to what they had done previously, you know, looking at performance outputs or symmetry or whatever you want to look at. The second layer is that qualitative, like, how are they doing it? And then the third layer is, you know, their level of preparation, their level of confidence. Like, those things need to be aligned before any of us even start having the conversation of like, okay, are they ready? And then there's even another layer of, okay, ready for what? Ready for practice, ready for, you know, high intensity, uncontrolled, chaotic movements, ready for game-like type of activities, or an actual game. Like, game being the first thing that somebody's exposed to is probably going to end in a lot of failure. But again, I think sometimes it depends on time of year. People are just like, even if it's a catastrophic injury, like, okay, now it's aligning with the playoffs. Well, the playoffs, you know, it's so important to get this person back. And like, yes, I acknowledge that. But like, okay, they have to pass these layers first before we get to that conversation of like, okay, we're going to take a little bit more risk because maybe the timeline called for, you know, this person to be out longer, but they're hitting all these quantitative marks qualitatively. They've done these things in practice, and then the athlete feels ready. They're prepared. So, I mean, those things aligning, yeah, we're never going to build this certainty around injury where it's like, we know 100% for sure this person's not going to get hurt, or they're going to get hurt. But it's like, you're playing with more certainty if those things are aligned.
So, Nate, you know, the return to play thing is as much, I guess, an art as it is anything. How has your philosophy developed or changed over time since you first got into this space, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good question. You know, I would say when I first got into it, it was just like, you would just, everything was so, it would go back to like objectivity, right? Where it's like, okay, you know, some of this late stage stuff, as we're getting closer to the sport, I'm going to let the sport kind of fill in the gaps. And early on, I'm just going to like, I'm going to look at movement quality. I'm going to look at pain. I'm going to look at like strength and maybe some power output speed type of stuff. So early on, it was a lot of like, do a really good job with whatever phase that you're given. So like, almost stay out of like the initial stage, like, okay, the injury has just happened. And like, I'm not going to do anything with this athlete until they're cleared to me, because I was not really understanding how these efforts could kind of blend across different domains. And so it was very compartmental, like, okay, my job is once they're cleared to me, I'm going to work movement quality, this, this, this. And then once I'm done with that, I just hand them over to the coaches. And now I think it's more so like we all just kind of bleed across these domains, right? Where it's, you hear this concept of stay in your lane. I don't believe in stay in your lane, but it's the idea of like, everybody is in a lane, but the lanes, you know, they don't have walls. Like we're free to kind of change and move into other domains as long as we're respectful of what kind of the roles and responsibilities of everybody in on board are, and knowing what those are. But ultimately, like, not just saying, okay, it's only time to do my job when like this person says it, and then it's my time to stop doing my job when the coach takes it over. There's still, you know, lots of areas where it's, okay, once they get back in the court, like, are we seeing that everything that we put into practice is actually coming to fruition, or where are the limitations? And having those conversations with coaches and saying, okay, what are the appropriate drills to be exposing them to? What are the requisite things that this person needs that we've actually exposed them to? And what are the things that we need to continue to build in terms of competency or in terms of, just volume, right? And even in this early stage return to play, like right after an injury's happened, like what kind of things can I do aerobically? How can I train unaffected limbs? You know, even if it's a lower body injury, how can I train the other limb? How can I train the rest of the body? You know, making sure that we're doing those things at a high level. And again, just not saying, well, we're going to shut off fitness. We're not going to do anything, because then it becomes very chunky where it's like, this person's maybe not loaded at all. And then as soon as they get exposed to any training, it's going to be like, it's going to be, you know, knocking them back on their heels. And then it's going to be a really slow process of just getting them fit again, or getting them to move again, or just getting them exposed to training. So again, finding ways to bleed across domains while still being respectful of people's spaces, but having hard conversations, challenging one another, like those things are important. Like any environment that I want to work in, like people value that. Like it's not questioning, it's asking questions, right?
And I guess I wrote down a quote here: ask the questions you didn't know you needed, so you find the solutions you didn't know you needed. I probably wrote that down incorrectly, but something along those lines.
Yeah, that makes no sense.
it's
I mean, it, you know, we are talking about strength coaches here, so technically it could make sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think I said that.
I've never heard those words in my life.
I don't know.
You're not as strong as the weights you don't lift, but stronger than the weights that you did. You're like, what the fuck did that just mean?
Oh, it makes sense.
Yeah. Sounds like offensive line coaches.
Only don't not never lift a weight when you're not feeling it. Think about that.
There it is.
Doesn't compute.
Yeah, it makes no sense.
not compute.
I always feel like Will Ferrell when he's like 60% of the time it works every time. He's like, that makes no sense.
Have you ever had a challenging conversation or been a part of an athlete's decision to retire at 20, 21, 22?
Yeah. You know, off the top of my head, I had, you know, this is one several years ago when I was at Eastern. This was just like a very unique case that an athlete that had come in, he was a walk-on that had an Achilles tear in high school. And then he got to Eastern and I think he came out for spring ball and tore his Achilles, but he had done really well prior to, and so he had been invited to come back on the roster. Well, once he tore his Achilles, it was, okay, well, you know, we're going to help you through this rehab process. And I mean, it was a 10-month deal. And I remember him coming back the next year, he'd come back for the next spring ball, had done really well. and had basically earned himself a spot on the main roster, right? Like he was going to be a traveler, you know, he's going to be like a three deep type of kid, a special teams kid. And then I think it was, I want to say, you know, towards the end of the season, just, you know, gone through the exact same thing. Another Achilles tear, his third Achilles tear, same leg. Yeah. Achilles tear, same leg. And I remember, you know, it was a kid that he did everything he was asked of him. And we were very stringent in process around, you know, what we needed to do to get him healthy. And again, it was a kid that was just bought in, very confident in his ability to go out and still do the things at a high level. And I mean, again, he showed that he could, even in the face of the, you know, two Achilles tears. Once he had that third one, I remember, you know, sitting him down in my office and just saying like, okay, like, what do you want to do? I'm here to help you. If you want to go back through it again, like, I know you were at the point of, you know, making a team, and that was your one goal, was getting on the roster, and you could probably be somebody that would have helped us. And I mean, he was playing that year, and he's just like, I don't think I can go through it again. And that was the first time. I mean, since then I've had some other different cases, but that was the one that stood out, because, you know, you just see, I wasn't part of the first one, saw the second one, saw everything that he went through. And it was just this ultimate success story of, like, you know, perseverance and making the team and doing all the things that he had hoped to accomplish. And then going down again in that season, just like that one really punches you in the gut. Actually named an award after the kid, at Eastern Washington. It was one of our strength and conditioning awards after that. But it's tough. I mean, people see injury and they don't really realize like how much goes into coming back from that. Not only, because we're not talking about, this is not general population where you're just going back to like, hey, I just need to be able to walk around or, you know, maybe do some kind of athletic things. We're talking about, you have to come back from something that's that significant to go try to, you know, do things that are the highest of high levels in regards to physical outputs. And when you go through that rehab process and it's so slow and it's so hard and it's daily and it's grind, it's twice a day. And then at the end of it, you're going right back through it again. You know, that really does weigh on them psychologically. So, you know, my thing is just, I'm always there. I try to be as level as I can with kids going through injuries and just be supportive of them. And, you know, just always speak back towards like, this is where we need to get to again. These are things that we need to make a priority of and just take it a day at a time. But, you know, again, there's times where I can't have empathy, like ACL tears for one, I've never had one. You know, I've had dislocated shoulder on my right arm several times. And then I had labral surgery in high school and then a broken hand in college. And those were kind of like the two significant injuries I went through. But I remember sitting in a room in college with 10 guys that I had come in with, and seven had torn their ACLs. One guy had torn both, and he ended up with a third ACL tear, one of the best wide receivers I've ever played with. And I didn't know what that was like to go through. And now living it with different kids at this level, you know, it really does weigh on you. You know, it's difficult. So when the time comes and they have to hang it up and it's not on their own terms, yeah, it's a difficult thing. But, you know, it's unfortunately I was literally having this conversation with an athlete the other day. It's like, injuries are non-discriminatory. They're inevitable. They're going to happen. It's just a matter of like, how do we respond to them? How do we come back and how do we stay mentally and physically as resilient as possible?
With Andrew Luck retiring recently, I know it's a hot topic. And did you have an opinion on that, or you just kind of see his take of he's looking towards the future?
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely like I'm in the camp of like, nobody knows what he's going through. You know, I remember watching him play in college and just being super impressed with like his physical profile and how he played. And he was just, you know, he just seemed like a guy that was going to take hits and do everything that he could to help his team win. And I'm sure the amount of preparation that he put in every year. And again, you think back, like, this is not just, you know, NFL all the way back to college, high school, however long he's played, all the time that he's put in. And you develop this love of the game and you kind of go through these routines and you have this expectation of like, this is how your body's going to hold up. And when those things start going south and you're not able to do the things that you need to do and you're not able to play the way that you want to play, and it just kind of keeps compounding on itself. I mean, missing an entire season and then having something that's nagging the next year. I mean, the guy is, to me, was an absolute warrior. So If you felt that strongly about like, this is just my time, like at the end of the day, this is a game and it's his body and it's his life. You know, I would fully support anybody in that type of situation, because again, you have no idea what they go through. No clue. You know, the armchair quarterbacks sitting at home have no idea what it's like to get sacked by a 300-pound plus dude, or like have no offensive line in front of you for several years when the expectations are like you're the franchise, you know? So again, I'm supportive of people like that and what their decisions are.
You got a view on that retirement?
I think every player has this like weird writing on the wall, and I think very few people get to retire when they want to. I mean, I think the only guy that I've ever met that actually got to walk away when he wanted to was Tony Gonzalez, and I was at his Hall of Fame induction speech. So,
yeah,
you know, I know for me, I still thought I had good football left in me, and it just came down to something where no longer does your body allow you to do the job at the level at which you want to. And even though there's always this like little spot in the back of your mind where you think like, man, maybe if I could just like steal for a year and just be like a good veteran guy to help like the young guys along and just be that good dude in the locker room. And then you're like, it wouldn't make me happy either, because then I'd be a fucking fraud like all those old dudes I used to call frauds when I was a young guy. And I used to come in, and some of the old guys, I used to pull my T-shirt over my face like this and go, give me the money. Give me the money. Be like, you fucking thieves, stealing from the team, not fucking playing. And yeah, I was an asshole. But I think a guy like Andrew Luck, one, being a pretty sharp dude, Stanford guy, pretty smart, you know, and shame on the Colts for not bringing in any fucking quality offensive lineman to guard that dude. The hits that guy took, man, I remember seeing him in his first couple years. It reminded me of the hits that Troy Aikman took. Remember when Troy Aikman came in Dallas, these guys were just killing Aikman. Every time I see Aikman up there like announcing, I always think like he's got to be fucked up just from those hits. He's also playing in the dome. I mean, dude, to play against the Colts in that dome, it's loud. So that turf is hard. It's just a weird thing, man, to like to play at a high level. And, you know, this kind of plays in perfectly with, you know, we had Dr. Bueller on the podcast, something the effect of like, you've played your whole life. You've done this job. You've played at the highest level. Your body has performed when you've needed it to at like the pinnacle, at the fastest, and just being able to like do all these things and then all of a sudden not be able to do it. It's like driving your car and like it doesn't turn right or the tires are funky and you're driving it and you're like, I don't know what's fucking wrong. And you can relate to this. You're like, something's wrong with my truck. I don't know what it is. Mm-hmm. It's exact same thing. You like the things that you used to be able to do easily, no longer you can do, and you don't understand why. And, you know, it's compounded. I mean, when you were sitting there talking about sitting in a room with 10 guys and seven of them had ACL tears, I saw a correlation between big hits where guys would take big impacts to the brain, have some form of concussion, some big hit. And then usually opposite side, if it was on the left or the right, usually the opposite side, they would end up having either some form of ankle or a torn ACL. And it was like a 1-to-1, a dude would get knocked out or take a big hit. And then like within a couple of weeks, he'd usually tear an ACL or fuck himself up. Yeah. And that's that, like, you know, cognitive neuro deal with Dr. Bueller was talking about. So when I saw Andrew Luck and like I could see the pain in him of like this confusion, and the problem comes down to is conventional medicine fails athletes. It always does, because there's limitations, you know, and you have these doctors, and I'm sure you deal with this with your ankle tapers, your ATCs and your doctors and all the other orthos who think they know, and they don't fucking know. They've never lifted a weight. They've never played. Very few of them have. And they make these observations based off of what they think. And a lot of times it's fucking nonsense. You know, they come in and evaluate injuries. Oh, this guy, I mean, these guys have heard me say it. I broke my fibula clean in half. The doctor came in and said, you don't need that bone to play football. It's a non-weight bearing bone, only 12% of your weight. So you don't need that bone. I'm like, doc, every time I take a step, I can feel this crunch. And they're like, yeah, but you don't need that bone to play football. I'm like, what about the Hippocratic Oath? Do no harm. And, you know, it's.
So what happened after that?
They cast me 5 days and I played 3 weeks later.
Mm.
So I played.
Sounds like they were right.
Played 17 weeks with a broken leg.
Absolutely. So these guys are sharp.
No, they're fucking assholes. And then what's crazy is it was my leg was in such spasm, I ended up rupturing my calf. And you know when you guys fucking rip on me for my my calf, ruptured calf.
Big spoon, little dish.
Yeah, Indianapolis Colts fucking ruptured. But so the long story is that they these doctors speak in such absolutes. Oh, you should be fine in this, and they're looking at it from an MRI, and they don't realize that there's a whole different system to this thing. I mean, that kid going out there, and like a little piece of me died when he told me he tore the same Achilles, and I like as I'm going through the mechanism, I'm thinking like, okay, was the surgery fucked up? Was the the way they reattached it, was it too tight? Did he not have full range of motion? Did they push him back too soon? Like, why didn't it heal? Normally when you have that form of like tendon rupture, when they stitch it back, and I only know this because I ruptured my patellar tendon, the tendon, the scar tissue creates this mass that actually makes it stronger. So then you're thinking like, why did he rupture it a second, a third time? I mean, the second time is tough. The third time you'd be like, ah, you know what? The anchor points are probably a lot shorter because they have to resect and resect. And then when they, you know, by the time he got to the third time, I mean, shit, it was probably so short. He probably had like no dorsiflexion.
No, and so he did not. That was always almost impossible to get back on this kid.
Yeah. So then it's so tight that he puts him into that same situation. And then you have to also think that there's all this like neurological guarding where, you know, the body fucking knows something's fucked up and it could be something from like some other injury. I mean, there's so many cascading effects. And, like a guy like Andrew Luck, to be able to play at that level and to be that good and to have that much talent and take those hits and then all of a sudden just stand up there and be like, I can't do it. Like think like the words coming out of his mouth, I was like, holy shit, man, I've been there. Like that was me where, you know, I had teams calling and like, hey, we want you to come try out. And I was like, I don't think I could do what I used to a year ago. Like it just doesn't like it was like my superpowers had left me. And I was actually going and seeing Dr. Bueller, and I remember walking out of Bueller's office, and I've told you guys the story. It was snowing, and I took a step, and I jumped up on the hood of the car, and I thought, fuck, I could go back and play in the NFL, and I stepped down, and I got in the car and just drove to the airport and went home. And my wife was like, what do you think? I'm like, I could go play today, no problem. She's like, it was that monumental. I'm like, yeah, unbelievable. But they stole 10 years from me. I'm not giving them anymore. And I think that's the way he probably looked at it. Like, something's wrong. I don't know how to fix it. If I go in there, it's going to be disingenuous. I'm not going to play at the same level at which I was. And that's a hard thing, too, when you start thinking about legacy. You want to be remembered for the player that you were, not like the shitty player you evolve, you know, you turn in. Yeah, you know, like, hey, that guy had so much future. He was so good. You know, he's a bust now, which is so quick, man. People hand that shit out to people all the time. And it's just like, as having done the job and hearing the callousness of fans and armchair quarterbacks and the way people act, like, fucking stabs me in the heart. I hear people say like the, you know, and it's just part of our culture where they think like, oh, you know, I bought my ticket. I got my jersey. Fuck this guy. And you're like, well, you know what? Like this is still a kid who fucking loved to play football and this is his dream. And he no longer can do the dream at which he wants to. And then to hear like fucking like them boo that dude. I was, I'll tell you this. I will root against the fucking Colts for their fans for the rest of my life for that shit.
Yeah,
it's why, like, I mean, shit, you guys have heard me at TV timeouts. We would stand there and we would watch the Philly fans just beat the dog shit out of each other. They would get hammered and just punch each other in the face. And we'd watch these epic fights. And I remember thinking, like, a lot of times they were fighting other Philly fans. And I remember just thinking, like, these are our guys. You know, these are the guys that are going to fucking throw cheesesteaks at us if we lose. I mean, it's just, but I'm stoked that that he had the courage to like step up and retire opposed from just fucking ride it out and just fade off and then be like, I just never came back. The guy, you know, just
or get totally fucked up
or go out there and say, hey, you know what? They paid me money. They expect me to do this job. And I have this loyalty to the fans and the team and this other stuff. And then go out there and just get absolutely fucking annihilated.
Yeah.
Which that's, you know, so I'll get off my soapbox.
No. I think obviously you have a tremendous perspective about that. It's, you know, one of my idols growing up was Barry Sanders. And I remember when he was 30, when he had got done playing. And everybody was like, why? He's still in his prime. And, you know, obviously there was things that were going on there behind the scenes in terms of contract and just, you know, disillusion and all that. But that being said, it's like, why is it that as a fan that we expect that the player should only walk away when, like you said, they basically tanked and their career is like they have no legacy. They're a shell of their former self, or they've experienced like a catastrophic injury and there's no way they could come back. Right. Like that's when we think that these people should be like, yeah, all right, now this is when I want to start my retirement, the rest of my life. Like, I have an injury that's going to affect me forever. Or, you know, I like you said, are a shell of my former self, and everybody's going to remember me as a bust, or, you know, not as good as I once was. It's pretty unfair that we have that mentality as fans. Like, that's what the expectation is. But then, like, it's the irony, or whatever you want to say it is, like, you know, I think about, you know, in like baseball, where who was the first baseman for the Phillies that recently retired, Ryan Howard, where, like, by the end of his career, he's hitting like 160 and has no power or anything like that. And people are like, oh, he should have got out of it earlier. It's like,
it's always easy to second guess and make these decisions after the fact. You know, the difference with baseball is, I think in baseball, guys realize, like, you know, they just don't have the speed, or they can't do it anymore. In football, you don't realize it until you, like, all of a sudden go out and take one big hit or something happens. I mean, for me, I chipped off a piece of bone in the last preseason game of my 10th year. And, you know, and then through, you know, some just interesting stuff, end up being like going to get knee surgery and then trying to come back. And then all of a sudden, you know, something that should have taken me a couple weeks, a couple months to recover from, all of a sudden, like 6-9 months later, like, my knee still swells. I can't run like I would run, and my knee would swell for 2 or 3 days. And it's all of a sudden, like, you just rehabbing back, the timeline doesn't compute anymore. I wasn't ready to go do the job with, like, the metrics and all the things that I'd put together. And then you just don't know why. And at that point, you got to figure out, like, hey, man, is it worth doing this, or do I have to go find? And I think the problem comes down to, and I've said it, like, you go talk to this conventional doctors, and it just reminds me of, like, you know, like, one medicine man has some voodoo, and another one has another. And you go to that one guy, and he just, you know, like, I remember going and seeing a doctor and him being like, oh, your knee's a mess, I would just do a knee replacement. And I'm like, what if I don't want to do a knee replacement? I can't help you. And I remember just going to different people. And then I went to, you know, this guy, and you start kind of going on this, like, little vision quest of, like, finding the right people, and you end up finding somebody that fixes you. And now, like, you know, and I just remember thinking, like, if you surround yourself in the same echo chamber of individuals, and in professional sports, you're either going to end up with a pill or a surgery. That's all they got. And, you know, like, I saw this PT Cairo today, and I hurt my neck in, I think it was in the preseason against the Rams, and I herniated a disc in my neck, and, like, I couldn't look around, and I wasn't going to play the first week. And this old time doc that we had, who was, not only an old time doc, but he also had racehorses, and he used to do manipulations, and he was an osteopath and used to work on racehorses, came in, and he fucking, like, did this karate chop thing on my neck, popped the fucking disc back in, and I was fine. And, like the doctor was like, we don't know what to do, we're going to inject it, let's do this and this and this. And he's like, I'll fix it. And he fucking did this little, like, karate, like, kind of like, and all of a sudden I, like, popped in, and I was like, oh, I'm good. And went out and played.
Dr. Ralph Macchio.
Oh, it was the craziest thing. And, like, I remember, you know, he was like, oh, there's going to be some swelling, put a little DMSO on my neck. And you would have thought he was fucking making fire for cavemen, showing these guys some, like just some DMSO. And they would, you know, these trainers had never seen it. And I'm like, how the fuck, like, what do you think existed before this year? And it just, to me, man, it just meant, like, if you listen to conventional wisdom, sometimes conventional wisdom will, you know, hey, this is the end, you know. And I'm sure Luck went to all these different doctors and said, hey, you know, hey, the, you know, this, and, you know, and they gave him everything. It just reminds me of, you know, Kobe Bryant, who, you know, had such bad tendonitis in his knees. I mean, it was basically arthritic changes, you know, all these problems, and couldn't do anything. Goes over to Germany, gets hooked up with the ACS stuff with those guys at Regenex, goes over there, and whatever happens, I don't know. There was a lot of voodoo in that thing. I know one of the doctors that went with him, who's since told me the stories, but shit, Kobe comes back and plays another 10 years and never had any issues. I mean, they were talking about he was done. His, I mean, the only other bigger upset that was LeBron James' hairline. Remember LeBron's? I mean, his hairline was back here, and the next year looked perfect. I mean, like, so a lot of these issues, man, like, you go to the doctors, they give you some conventional, and the really sharp people, the, you know, and I'll tell you this, I stand on this 100%, that if Andrew Luck had met Dr. Buehler, he wouldn't have had to retire. So if anybody, you know, I mean.
Well, how long was he playing?
Luck only played 7 years. Hmm. Like, that's, we have a doctor in Utah, who's really interesting guy. We had him on the podcast, a guy named Craig Buehler, Amit, and he does some stuff with like a ton of Olympic athletes. I met him through Tom Inkadon, who met him through Romanowski. And he was the trainer that worked with John Stockton and Carl Malone and allowed those guys to play 20 plus years through his what he does. And for people that, like, you know, medicine's failed them, this, I mean, he seems to be able to work that magic, and he did for me. And so, like, the thing comes down to, I think, as an athlete, if the only resource you have is like, hey, you know, conventional, I just think that you get to the point where it just kind of runs out and you got to go out and find them. I'm sure for you, I mean, the analogy I always give people is when I came to the Eagles, Mike Wolf and Tom Canavy were strength coaches. They were Penn State guys, and they were all hammer strength, hit one set to failure. And I remember jumping in. It was like one, two, or three. You just run the row. And I got done with one, and I was like, can I go again? And I would just do the row. I'd be like, hey, I got 45 minutes. I want to do this as many times as I can. And they were like, yeah, fucking do it. And I just remember thinking, like, this is the program they had. This is the philosophy they did. And then I remember at the end of the season, they were like, hey, when are you going to come back for offseason? I was like, I'm not. I'm going to go do my own training, because if I do this shit, I'm going to be out of the fucking league. And it like, you know, and this was, but that's what they did. That's what the reduced injuries. Nobody got hurt. You're in the NFL. So, like, everything fucking works. You can have dude do one set to failure, and he's probably going to get bigger and stronger. A dude over there could fucking play the snare drum for an hour and probably get bigger and stronger. You know? So, like, when you were laughing about going and working with other athletes, it's kind of like the dogma of professional sports and college sports is you bring, you know, these strength coaches in and, you know, I'm going to work with Alabama and we're going to make them great. I'm like, you get the best fucking recruits. It's like here at Texas. The fact that Texas doesn't win every game blows my mind with the quality of recruits they bring in. But the problem is there's this, you know, chip on the shoulder, like, we're Texas. People should just roll over, and they go in there and get their fucking asses beat. And it just becomes this really weird thing, man. That's why.
Bring McConaughey in, coaching staff.
But I mean, and that's why when you see in the NFL, like the guys, like, it blows my mind. You'll get these guys from little schools will come in and fucking go to the Hall of Fame. Ty Law. I mean, shit, all these guys do this because it comes down to, like, how hard you want to work, perseverance. Can you do this job in and out, in and out? So.
How much time you have left to do that job too? Like you said, how much was taken away from you before you even got to the NFL?
Oh, yeah. So. Yeah, I mean, just the injuries that work up. I mean, yeah. I mean, it's...
Yeah. Ty Law, did he play for the Rams?
Patriots, and then also played with me at the Chiefs.
Maybe at one point. Let me check.
Because I want to say the year was 1992. The Summers family took a...
No, Ty Law ain't that old.
Who's the other Law? I think he has a brother. Look it up, McQuilkin.
Talking about Kevin Green.
We'll just go with this real quick.
92.
1992, and the Summers family went on a scuba diving trip to a Club Med resort in St. Lucia. And one of the activities they had was like a flag football game with NFL guys. And who Bob Golic was there.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, because that was the Golic brother on Saved by the Bell, right?
Well, there was Bob, and then there was Mike Golic. The Mike's the one who has a radio show.
Yeah. Mike. But, yeah, so it's Bob Golic, yeah, for sure.
Who played for the Raiders, who was a fucking madman.
And I want to say it was tight. Like, there was like five dudes there, like, knowing you now, and like, what those dudes probably ravaged that Club Med resort.
Oh, yeah, they were there drinking, eating, everything. Yeah.
And, but it was like those guys were like split half-half, and they did this like fun flag football game. I had been playing football for like 3 years, and fucking Ty Law ran a slant across the fucking middle. I was playing inside, and he fucking pummeled me. And I went down. He like just Charlie horsed me and just plowed me. Like, and he felt awful. Like, you know, he didn't fucking know. He was just running a slant probably at half speed, which is 100 miles an hour.
Ty Law was a DB.
Yeah, but they were on both sides. You know what I mean? So like there was Bob Golic's team, and I want to say it might not be Ty Law, but
95 was his rookie year with the Patriots.
Okay, so then it's got to be a different.
Yeah, because he came, I want to say, like 06, 07.
Yeah, he was at the Chiefs.
Yeah. No, I played with
this
Ty.
This played on the Rams. I definitely have it mixed up. But poor Ty Law, if you hear this, what? Like, you'll ever hear it. Oh, sorry for the...
friend of the show.
Yeah. Pummeled. And then they gave us, like, a free dinner and everything because it was a big deal.
Because they pummeled you?
Poor kid was, like, down and KO'd.
Well, at least you didn't fucking spill, you know, as he's coming across the middle, fucking light up his knee and blow out his knee
like,
in a
flip. Wouldn't that be something if he like,
you're like 12 years old and you put your fucking head inside and just blow his fucking knee out as he's running the crowd like a slant?
They shouldn't have had kids playing that flag football game.
What, things they would never do today. Being like a bunch of kids playing flag football against these NFL dudes
my folks
who are like, in Club Med.
Whatever.
Having a bunch of drinks and they were like, hey, Bob Golic's like, hey, I'm going to throw a fucking shiver on this kid's fucking face.
I'm going to get more intel on this. Yeah. And so this story gets more formalized and accurate.
I have a funny Bob Golic story. So Chris Schell, when I was growing up, Art Schell was head coach for the Raiders. Chris Schell was his son who played on my high school football team. And I remember we got to go to one of the games when his dad was head coach and we were in the locker room and fucking Bob Golic was by far the friendliest dude that we had met. And he was fucking kind of a madman, had like long hair. He was a big fucking
bearded
dude.
Yeah. Yeah, he was a gruesome looking dude. He was super nice. Yeah.
Yeah. And his brother is just kind of fattening on the radio.
Mike and Mike in the morning.
Oh, people love him.
I'm out.
Yeah, I'm not a fan.
Where are we at, McQuilkin?
Too safe. Let's stick with, I'd like to get into managing personalities, and I guess this ties into our conversation a little bit with the NFL. But Nate, I know you're were once a wide receiver. I don't know about a diva wide receiver, but how is it managing the different personalities that you face on your teams with that one objective of winning and being a successful unit, but all these different personalities, especially does one dominating personality pull away? Are there conflicts amongst the team members? How do you go about managing and almost molding the team through strength training and shared suffering and all that good stuff that we love about strength and conditioning?
Yes. I mean, that's a good question, right? Cause I work with both men and women. And so people ask, you know, what's different. I'd say on the men's side, it's typically like the motivation to like, just want to be in the weight room and want to be around like the other bros in the team. Like just get, I had a freshman swimmer come in the other day and he showed me like the Dom Mazzetti bro science, like the eight, there are seven stages of like, basically like, you know, how they were going to evolve. And he's like, we're the ooze right now, but we're working on being the super beast. And, you know, he was talking about, yeah, we caught our first pump today. And like, I think it's just more of the culture of like, they've, you know, it, like that's what they would do otherwise. Right. Like they'd go to the gym and maybe do different exercises, but that's, they enjoy being there. So personality wise, like, yeah, you got some different guys on the team, but for the most part, from a strength conditioning perspective, I think most of them, like they just become second nature. They want to be there. On the women's side, there's some just different perspectives. Some of them are pretty intrinsically motivated and they're like, okay, this is for my sport. And I'm going to do whatever I need to do. You have some that are more extrinsically motivated and it's going to be like, all right, playing time is what matters to me. So if my coach is saying I need to be here, I'm going to do it. Then you have others that, you know, have opinions of like, if I change too much, my body's going to change too much. I'm not going to be as effective. And you know, maybe some of these things, like, I feel like our football lifts or like, this is not what, you know, a swimmer does or what a women's basketball player does. So a lot of times with them is, you know, you talk about this term education, but like education for them is just saying like, okay, at the end of the day, what my job is to do is to help you be successful in your sport. I'm not here to make you a power lifter, Olympic lifter, but we're going to use tools that are necessary in order to impact strength or power or resiliency. And it might seem a little bit goofy, but ultimately like this is why we're doing it. I think that's where you start. If it becomes like, it's still defined off of that, then I think a lot of times you have to be really honest and forthright with people. Like I think they respect that a lot more than kind of dancing around it. Like, hey, this is what the expectation is. And like, you're going to get on board or else it's going to be a conversation that's at a higher level where it's going to go up to your coaching staff. And then it's going to be about, you know, taking things away that you're here to do, which would be playing time and, you know, things of that nature. Cause at the end of the day, like if I'm taking away strength and conditioning for some of these kids, you'd be like, all right, sweet. Like, I don't have to do this anymore. So you have to find kind of what their whys are, what make them tick. And you're typically able to figure that out pretty quickly with most kids. And, you know, there is kind of this social savvy that you have to have, but ultimately you know, the expectations are the expectations. Like I try not to say I'm going to have different standards for you because you really love this versus you don't think this is important. Like the standards are the standards and I'm going to hold you to those. And again, be honest when you're not meeting what the expectations are. But I also deal with college kids. I'm not dealing with pro athletes where, you know, I'm making a fraction of what they are and they're going to maybe make more of the call on what they think is important, or they're spending more time in the off season with their own personal trainers. Or, you know, I've even heard stories. I had the guy was telling you about Rick Hughley was telling me a story about a gentleman named Robin Pound, who Robin was a head basketball strength coach at Cal back in the day. And I think he was with the Phoenix Suns. And somehow, I mean, Robin's, I think, probably in his 60s or maybe 70s now. He got hooked up with Kyrie Irving. And at one point, he was Kyrie Irving's personal guy. So wherever Kyrie was, I think this is when he was with Cleveland, like Kyrie wasn't training with the trainer, like the strength and conditioning coach that was there. He was training with Robin Pound. So it's like, again, you know, how you deal with those personalities. Like, I'm not at that level. I wouldn't have the slightest clue. I would try to, again, have a similar mindset of what I had now. I don't know if it would be as effective. Probably not. But, you know, there's a reason why I've not ventured into the pro game.
How about managing coaches? So any guidance for strength coaches out there or business owners that need to navigate the sport coach to try to get some more clientele, whether it's high school or maybe even some smaller college towns, to help them just connect with the sport coach and get buy-in for a type of training that's performance versus, I don't know, all the nonsense that we see forced on different coaches.
I start with every sport coach that I work with is just trying to meet them at a human level, right? Like, you know, their entire lives are really centered around sport. That's all the conversation. That's all anybody wants to talk to them about. So I try to meet them on as much of a human level to start with, at least trying to build somewhat of a relationship that, you know, for example, I'm actually in my women's basketball coach's office right now. So he's out of town recruiting. But he's a huge Cowboys fan. So I know when I get around him, if I'm mentioning things about the Cowboys or we're talking about the Rangers, I mean, he grew up in Dallas. Typically, like, those are things he's going to like speak fondly on, and it's going to open up a little bit more juice for me to have conversations about stuff that maybe he doesn't want to talk so much about. And then, you know, I ask him what he thinks is important about, you know, what his team needs to be able to do to be successful, and then what he thinks my role needs to be. And then as long as we're viewing those things pretty similarly, like I'll be fairly cordial. If he thinks it's something completely different, then I, again, try to use that term education. And so I'll invite him into the weight room. I invite him around training sessions, you know, talk to him a lot. It's just that consistent exposure. And I think a lot of people, the tendency is in this industry is when things get uncomfortable and, you know, somebody thinks you're not doing a good job, like, you just avoid it, you know, like, I don't want to talk to them. Oh, they don't know what they're talking about. I think that is the opposite. Like, you got to run towards those situations, and you almost have to, you know, over communicate or spend more time around them. And again, whether or not you get to the root of the issue with every conversation, that's beside the point, but you can't run from, you know, uncomfortable situations or conflict. Like, you know, if you just, at the end of the day, like, ah, they're an idiot, I'm not going to deal with them, I'm just going to do my own thing. Like, how is that going? Like, what is that ultimately going to accomplish? Like, that's not going to manifest into something that's really probably that successful. You might not agree on things, you know, 100%, but ultimately, you know, we chose a profession that we chose. We don't get to be the sport coach. Like, I don't get to go make the calls on what they do in basketball practice. I don't. That's never going to be my job. So I'm just doing my best to support them from a physical, you know, standard, and understand more about what practices look like and games. And then, you know, really where you need to be unified. I know this isn't, you know, necessarily addressing people that are outside of this realm, but you need to be unified as a support staff to be able to go, okay, well, we have a unified message, whether or not we're on the same page. We have a unified message in how we're communicating back to this sport coach. So if we're completely, you know, 180 degrees different, at least we're unified in that message. So they're not hearing something different from everybody else. Cause that's another thing where, you know, if a sport coach comes talk to the strength coach and it's like, hey, we're not strong enough. And then they might talk to somebody in sports medicine and they say, yeah, well, they're doing the wrong exercises, or they're not addressing these things, and that's why maybe injuries are happening. So, I mean, what does a sport coach think? They want to be like, okay, what's the quickest fix? What's the easiest thing that we need to do? And then they might start to assign, like, well, they have expertise in sports medicine and injury prevention, and you don't. So you need to do what they're doing or what they're talking about. So again, that lack of unification between the support staff can really undermine what you're trying to accomplish in regards to, you know, that communication with the sport coach.
Preach.
Yeah. What Done is, this a long time.
Yeah, man.
No, it's well thought out. I always wonder about like the, you know, the journey of like bringing kids in, especially like a, you know, 18-year-old kid, especially, I mean, even working with the girls, which I think is always interesting too, in that you almost have to sell them like, hey, this is a performance-based program. It's going to allow you to do your, like you said, you know, the guys just want to come in and bang some weights and fucking be some bros. Whereas sometimes the girls, you got to get in there and like explain to them, hey, this is going to benefit you. But seeing that like maturation process from like 18 to 21, 22 years old, where all of a sudden like, hey, the program that we did when we first started is very different than the one that we're doing later on. And then you have, you know, like women's team sports where you have these kids that are, you know, really following the span. So I sometimes wonder, you know, like how does the program change? How does it evolve? You know, what's the narrative? How does it build over time? Opposed from, you know, talking to somebody in their fourth or fifth year, opposed from that, you know, first year kid.
Yeah. I think what I try to do is, I mean, it's kind of like what we talked about earlier. If you're understanding personalities, there's some kids that like, they just want to check the box. Right. And I don't say that in a bad way, but they like, okay, I'm good in a team environment. Like, give me what you think I need to do and I will do it. And, you know, over time, you're going to give me some of my testing and how I've developed and maybe some different stuff in different areas to help build me up where I'm, you know, not as good. And I'm good with that. And, you know, that's probably the majority of the kids kind of fit in that camp. But you also have the kids that like, they see, okay, I'm in the group setting and now I'm starting to develop a little bit differently, or, you know, I played a little bit more, I got a little bit more mileage and I want to know more of the whys. I maybe want to, you know, connect on a different, in a different forum, right? So I'd rather have like a one-on-one. I want to spend more time kind of working on the things I need to work on. I want it to be on my time as well. You know, I have kids that will be like, I really like to get a workout in after practice, as opposed to, you know, they're always telling me I you know, my lift's Monday, Wednesday, Friday, but shoot, I want to get it on a Tuesday. I think I could do something here. I try to find what, if there are kids that need that, like give them those opportunities as well. Like, yeah, I can't personal train everybody, but like, if that's the setting that is going to benefit you a little bit more, 'cause then we can kind of play mad scientist a little bit, like that's great. And as kids start to go through the program, like I hope that I always have a handful of kids that are kind of in that boat or in that camp as well, that I kind of just be like, I need some extras, or I need some different stuff, or what else can I do? 'Cause I want to be better than everybody else. So give me what I need to have. And so, you know, exercises will change and sets of reps and all those things, but I think it's really starting to connect with them from a relationship standpoint and see like, what is the coaching communication style that you need? What's the time that you need? What's that commitment look like? And even like, how do you want to be run through a workout? Like, some of these kids don't want to have any conversation. They just want it to be about like, just tell me what to do and I'll do it. And other kids want to spend half the time talking about other stuff. And it's not that they're not giving the same amount of effort, and it's not that they're getting the same amount of benefit. It's just, that's the way that they're wired. You know, I think about women's basketball. I got a couple kids right now that are in that camp that, if it was just about like, yeah, I'm just going to give you this sheet and yeah, I'm going to coach you, but they just wouldn't get as much out of it. They just wouldn't. So I see the best coaches at the strength conditioning level, like start to diversify the program around, again, that the relationship that they have with that kid and how they've kind of discussed what that path is going to look like and what's going to lead them to success. And then, you know, really working on being consistent with that.
Shifting gears a little bit, and I'm curious, how have you evolved your internship program or your coach development program? I recall Bob Leo having at NC State, like maybe one of the few paid intern gigs. Correct me if I'm wrong, but how have you gone through that Georgia experience, walking in where more than half the kids are in that red shirt as the volunteer, to now in a position where you can empower and educate a young coach?
Yeah, I think we're just given more options right now. You know, we've had everything from, okay, people that just want to come in, like strength conditioning is their thing, right? So, you know, we build curriculum around that and what that experience looks like. We have other kids that come in that kind of want to be more of a hybrid, like I like the S&C side, but I also like some of the behind the scenes, the tech side. And so we have, you know, depth of knowledge on our staff in those areas as well. So their experience looks different, and they might spend time with different people on the staff that have more of that skill set or expertise. And then you have, you know, we still have that one position that kind of serves as like, okay, if you've gone through an internship, but you're, you know, not quite into a full-time role, or we don't have that available, where we can still kind of float the boat to be able to pay you hourly and give you more autonomy and give you more leadership opportunity. So, you know, that is still one of the options as well. So, you know, most schools just have the unpaid internship, and it's like everybody gets the same curriculum. Everybody has the same experience, regardless of kind of where you need to fit. I think right now we're doing a good job of kind of diversifying what our offerings are between, you know, S&C intern that probably is more in line with your, you know, undergrad or in grad school, more of kind of that sports science hybrid role. And then, you know, a true, like, okay, you're an assistant, you're getting paid hourly, and then you'll get opportunities to interview, you know, for full-time roles when they come up, or even within. And so that's where I think that, you know, we have, I think, four right now that are in different internship roles, but like personalities are completely different, and where I envision them ending up in regards to their career. Like, some of them might be, you know, true S&C, like collegiate. Some of them are going to be, you know, data science, and some of them might be in a completely different industry altogether. So hopefully they're all getting something that they feel like, hey, I'm being challenged. It's meeting me where I'm at with what my interests are. And, you know, I'm accomplishing or building towards something that would help me in my future.
Have you seen the industry, strength and conditioning industry, change over the last 10 years, and any kind of forward vision based off those changes that you've seen for the next 10 years?
No question. I mean, there's just a lot of different types of people that are getting involved in the industry that maybe before there was more, you know, like we talked about earlier, there was kind of more that carbon copy, like, hey, I played college football, I really like to lift, and I want to be a strength coach. And I'm going to, you know, those were like 80% of the people that were, you know, at the collegiate level. And now you're seeing, you know, maybe more of just a varied background of people that, you know, hey, I like sport. Maybe played a little bit in high school, and then, you know, I've kind of got this data science background. I think that, you know, I can still help out with some of the monitoring and some of the, you know, bar speed tracking and things of that nature. You know, so I just think that there's just a more of a variety of people that are coming in because there's more opportunities. There's just more, you know, different types of roles that people can get into. So, you know, in terms of what's being offered, in regards to what a typical day in a weight room looks like, I would say in the last 10 years, there's probably more layers of stuff, maybe sometimes, you know, not misappropriated, but just it's more, you know, paralysis, right? Where it's like there's so many different places that you're able to take in information in regards to social media or, you know, the internet, just pulling up every program and knowing kind of what everybody else is doing. So you're seeing programs that maybe don't represent like having a clear goal in mind. So, you know, I'm not saying that's better or worse. I just think that people are trying to say like, I have to fulfill a lot of these, you know, different needs. Like, I have to be a mobility wizard, and I have to understand energy system development, and I have to be able to get somebody really strong, and I have to test these things at a high level. I think you're seeing more people feel like they have to do more. So that's where I'm hoping over time that they're saying, okay, you know, we can build in more positions. I think, you know, we're not building new colleges, so building in more positions to allow people to work maybe at a higher level within a team, and then having these different personalities or different skill sets to be able to serve, like, okay, we have a breadth of knowledge across the board with, you know, the physical training piece, but we need some people that have depth of knowledge in monitoring. We need some people that have depth of knowledge in, you know, player tracking, and to be able to have those kind of, you have those generalists on your staff, and then you have some more specialists. And again, you're seeing some of the bigger schools kind of have that. It's not consistent across the board yet. I think it's obviously where there is money, there's going to be more of those opportunities.
More money, more problems.
More money, more opportunity.
So you say so more opportunities, more problems?
Interesting. Yeah. That's probably
accurate. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
So that's why you do nothing.
I didn't know you were a nihilist.
Nihilist.
Exactly.
Got anything else? Nate, anything else you want to talk about?
No, I really appreciate the time, and I mean, this has been fun. This was kind of a breath of fresh air. Yeah. Just to be able to kind of talk about different topics and jump down some different rabbit holes. So, you know, hopefully, that's something, you know, your listeners can get something out of. And if they have any questions, they want to reach out to me. I don't know if you'll post email or social media links or anything like that. Yeah. Feel free to reach out. I think I do pretty well at, getting back. I'm not, you know, on call all the time, but I'm pretty reachable for a strength coach.
Well, for the people who are too lazy to go to the post, why don't you just tell them how to find
you? Yeah, there you go. On Twitter, it's just N Brickerson. And my name is, if you think it's E-R, just reverse it. It's R-E-S-O-N. I'm sorry. I don't know why they spelt it that way. So N Brickerson is Twitter and Instagram. And then email is NateBrickerson@gmail.com.
There you go.
Pretty
young,
simple.
Aspiring strength coaches. Maybe those in this room that are not allowed to talk or be on camera.
We got an intern in the corner.
Oh, yeah. Nate, nice. Sorry about that. No, don't you wave at him. So he's waving at you. He's not supposed to be doing that. In fact, he's not supposed to be making eye contact, even with a television version of you.
He's waving us. At the TV version of you. There's a, I don't know.
Yeah,
so you can't see it.
Don't look
now
at me.
Hang on. Now he's hip thrusting.
Don't his pants look are coming at me.
No, Nate, thanks again, man. And yeah. Power Athlete Nation. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Premier Podcast in dramatic pause. Strength and conditioning.
Ing.
Ing?
Yeah, that was so dramatic.
Pause.
People think it was broken. But all right, man. Thanks, Nate.
All right. See you. Yep. Take care, guys.
Drop on. Now it's time for you to empower your performance. Follow Nate on social media, both Instagram and Twitter, at N Brickerson, or contact him by email, natebrickerson@gmail.com. And don't forget, he's got that funny last name that is R-E-S-O-N. That's right. It goes against everything that you want to type, I promise. Until next time, bye!
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply, in-app only.